Part of Exodus you've all been waiting for. This is not really the part they make the movies over, you know? The law. The application of the words of God, the 10 words. It's what we begin to look at today. It was almost 2 weeks ago that an American senator from Virginia, who was also the former governor of Virginia, who was also a former nominee for Vice President of the United States, his name is Tim Kaine, made a revealing statement about human rights and American law. When Secretary of State Marco Rubio, during a Senate committee hearing, made the statement, quote, "Our rights come from God, our Creator, not from our laws, not from our governments," unquote. Senator Kaine responded, quote, "I find that very, very troubling. I am a devout person. I was a missionary in Honduras. We've got other devout folks in this room, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, American. The notion that rights don't come from laws and don't come from government, but come from the Creator, that's what the Iranian government believes. It's a theocratic regime that bases its rule on Shia law and targets Sunnis, Baha'is, Jews, Christians, and other religious minorities. And they do it because they believe they understand what natural rights are from their Creator," unquote. What a fascinating statement, especially from a sitting U.S. senator who's been a U.S. senator for 12 years. Despite the fact that a sitting U.S. senator just contradicted one of the most foundational directive documents of our republic, the Declaration of Independence, which says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Despite the fact that Senator Kaine contradicts one of our founding documents, Mr. Kaine revealed that his view is that laws have no connection to anyone outside of human government. Laws, then, have no connection to God. That's his viewpoint. That is a worldview. That is a prominent worldview today, that our laws have no connection to God or to deity. It's just not a biblical worldview. And it's not a new worldview. Many nations throughout human history have constructed legal systems based on a variety of motivating factors, some of which have little to nothing in connection with God. Maybe it's the greater good, the desires of the dictator, the popular vision of the time, and on we could go. Ancient cultures had significant written codes of conduct, some of which tend to read very similar to that you'll find in the Old Testament, like what we're reading now. And that should not really surprise us. Some scholars conclude, with the similarities that you're going to find here in Exodus and other ancient written codes of law, some scholars conclude, well, Israel must have just copied their laws from those ancient cultures that preexisted them. What's more likely is that ancient cultures had adapted their stories and their laws to what actually happened, replacing creation with God with stories involving many other gods. Because from what we know, from what the Bible tells us, Israel's account of the creation of the world and Israel's laws come directly from God himself. It reveals what actually is. That means the other nations are actually mimicking what God established. And whether they realize it or not, ancient cultures that developed laws that valued life, opposed murder, stealing, upheld property rights of people, were all reflecting a recognition that people are actually made in the image of God. What they value is ultimately connected to what is instilled in them by their Creator, even when they try to remake it all. Israel's laws came directly from God, the Creator. Israel did not construct them. They did not originate these laws from among themselves. This wasn't Moses sitting down on the mountain thinking, what would be a good way to live among us? This was divine dictation. God said this, Moses wrote it down, Israel was to obey it, as if these were the very words of God, because they were. So as we've been studying in the Ten Commandments, Israel's laws were given as a means of showing the rest of the nations what it looked like to appropriately display the image of God. How do you show the world the character of God? You show it through the people of God and how they live. And the display of the image of God is seen in how we love God supremely and then love each other appropriately. And as we saw, the Ten Commandments of Exodus chapter 20, that was actually the preface to the rest of the legal code that would govern the nation of Israel. So what we find beginning in Exodus 21, going all the way through Exodus 23, are a more detailed legal description of cases or case law, examples of how loving others and respecting property and honoring truth, etc., looks in the everyday life of God's people. These laws are directly related to God. You cannot separate these laws from what they say about the Creator. How Israel would live according to these laws told the rest of the world, what kind of God do you serve? It's the whole point of the law. They're directly related to God. The chief motivation for having and obeying any and all of these laws was to demonstrate loyalty, love, devotion to the one true God. And we would see how a people love God by how they then love each other. If you have laws that have no connection to God, what would ever then motivate obedience to those laws? Would it just merely be the fear of government? Well, that's how some nations are run. Who or what will define those laws? Would it be every just cultural whim of the more politically active? Would it just be the influential class of the nation that determines what laws will be and how people will act and respond? What happens to a society that derives its laws from shifting cultural pleasures that change so often and change so violently? One act of violence, we might determine, deserves another act of violence for no connection to God, no relationship to Him, just because we're angry. What kind of culture will you create if it's driven by anger? No, Israel's laws came from God because they would reflect God. They were motivated to obedience because the people of God loved God. And that would express a stable, lasting love for each other. The overriding emphasis that we see in Exodus 21 to 23 is how these laws display love for others. These chapters contain the laws that would govern Israel so that they would love others in a way that loves God. This morning we're just going to focus on chapter 21. It'll probably stir up enough problem that we have to wait till next summer to get to chapters 22 and 23. Because next week we'll get back to Revelation, doom, gloom, judgment, etc. Actually, we'll get back to the glory of God expressed in His judgment and His soon return. But today we'll just focus on Exodus 21. And these are laws that express a love for life. Laws that preserve, protect, honor, and value the life of those who bear the image of God. Exodus 1 describes laws that love other people out of a love for God. That's the great theme of the chapter. loving others in detail because of a love for God as a priority. So, what kind of laws in Israel would show a love for others in a way that prioritized the love for God? That's what we're going to look at. We'll see two emphases today in Exodus 21 that governed Israel so that they would love others out of love for God. Just two emphases. First, laws that protect the least influential. Laws that protect the least influential. Who would be the least influential in Israel? Slaves. These are the laws that govern slavery. Now, before we look at the details, look carefully at verse 1. Now, these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. The ordinances. You compare this to what we saw in Exodus 20, verse 1, when we saw the revelation of the words of God, the 10 words, the 10 ideals. Now we get to the ordinances that reflect the application of those ideals, of those words. The word ordinance, it's found in some 406 verses in the Old Testament. It's a frequent term. In the book of Genesis, it could refer to the application of justice, or simply an act being accomplished in a just way. So when you get to the book of Exodus, this word ordinance refers to a regulation or a custom or a rule or a plan. It's a judgment or an act of justice, a decision or a rule that provides a legal standard so that you would know what is right, what is just. So how do you take the 10 words and apply them in a just way in a variety of circumstances and cases? Well, here we will see detailed for us legally mandated examples of how God's standards should be carried out in a variety of contexts. And God begins the entire discussion of the ordinances and the application of his law in applying it to slaves. These are the laws regarding slavery. So immediately when we read them, we're confronted with a difficult subject. Is the Bible, is the Old Testament actually advocating, is it condoning slavery? It seems that the Bible, at least as it appears from this point in biblical history, is certainly not calling for the abolition of slavery altogether. And it's giving instruction on how to operate within a slavery context. So what the Bible does say about slavery, it's a valid question. I also think that it's a valid question and it's a valid issue to consider what slavery was in the ancient world in contrast to what slavery was in our own nation's history, because that's where our mind goes. Throughout ancient history, slavery was an embedded institution in almost every culture in ancient history. It was a fact and a reality of life. People were owned and used to accomplish work for another person. It is worth keeping in mind that any import of a modern understanding or a social standing of family dynamics and economic structures and employment opportunities in the ancient world, the idea of what we have today in those structures is far removed. Far removed. For Israel, in regard to slavery, we should note that forcibly stealing people and forcing them into labor was never condoned. I mean, you saw that, you heard it read. Look at verse 16 just for a moment, chapter 21. He who kidnaps a man, he who steals a person, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, he shall surely be put to death. The modern idea of slavery, especially as it was defined in our own country and our own national experience of going to another place and stealing human beings and forcing them to do labor, that would have brought the death penalty in ancient Israel. It was never condoned. So that can't be the idea of slavery that's found here in this context. So what was slavery like? Well, look carefully down at verse 2 of chapter 21. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh, he shall go out as a free man without payment. Here's the ordinances in regard to citizens of Israel, Hebrews, who become slaves. You say, how in the world could that be? Well, I want you to think about their context. Here's an entire nation, Israel, numbering in the millions, and they have no social security system, no health care system, no employment regulations, no welfare system whatsoever. It's also a very agrarian culture. What did Israel as a people do for a living in Egypt? They were shepherds. That's what they knew how to do, keep sheep. So what do you do when you find yourself now a new nation, now in the wilderness, perhaps going into the promised land and inhabiting a land where all you really know how to do is be shepherds? What if you find yourself with no income, no means of gaining income? Because employment, as we understand it today, did not exist in the ancient world. You didn't just go out and find a job. You didn't show up at the local agency and sign up and say, can I get some unemployment insurance until I land a job? There is no resume to fill out. You don't have anything to put on the paper. And you have really no means to make any income. So what would you do? Well, you might ask someone, you might tell someone, I'll give myself completely to you to work in your home under your constraint so that I have provision. And in that ancient world, when that happened and you come under the oversight of another family, that ruling husband, that ruling man, what could be called the master, would provide for every need that you had, and you would work for them. And you would do all that they needed so that they could have provision and you could have provision. Housing, clothes, food, work were all given in exchange for complete loyalty to the family that you gave yourself to. Slaves in the ancient world were considered part of the family unit. That's why when you see commandments regarding slaves, even in the New Testament, have you ever noticed that it's in connection with instruction regarding the family? Like in Ephesians chapter 5 and 6, wives, husbands, children, parents, slaves. Because slaves were a part of the family unit. They were provided for by the family. That was true throughout the ancient world, not just in Israel. What is interesting to note in ancient cultures, some of those ancient cultures had rules regarding slavery. Not all of them, because not every ancient culture cared. They had slaves, but they didn't care how slaves were provided for. They were slaves. They were viewed as simply owned property. In some cultures, the Code of Hammurabi, for example, there were slave rules. But when you found those slave rules, they were at the very end of the entire structure of laws. Almost like something they added at the very end of it. Where did the laws regarding slavery begin in Israel's law? They're first. Slavery, especially slavery among Hebrew people themselves, according to what we see here, had to be limited. Do you see that? It had to be regulated in such a way that it put constraint on the one who provided for the slave, not on the slave himself. You see it in verse 2. If there's a Hebrew slave who gives himself to another, he shall serve for how many years? 6 years. But on the seventh, you let him go out as a free man without payment. So the seventh year becomes a sabbatical year, just like you had a Sabbath day. And what was that Sabbath day for in Israel? Well, we studied that. The Sabbath day comes after every 6 days. You would set aside one day in which you anticipated the coming rule of God, where everything would be just as it was on the seventh day of creation. Perfect, complete, without sin. So what about those in the culture, like slaves, who are the most uninfluential people in the culture? And they're a part of your people, citizens of Israel. And they have great need, and they bring themselves under your home. You can have them work for you for 6 years. On the seventh year, it's a sabbatical year, where you're actually anticipating a season where everything is perfect. A season and a time and an era to come when everything is restored as God made it, which should give you an idea that in the coming new world, there is no slavery. People are not enslaved to each other. Provision is ample for everyone. No one has need. God provides for everyone all that they need in the new and coming world. And so if this is part of you and your people, how will you treat them? Well, you're not going to just keep them under your own system as a family and make them work for you indefinitely. No, you're going to acknowledge God in regard to them and let them go in the seventh year. This would have been so powerful in the mind of Israel. Where had they just come from? Egypt. In which they were slaves for how many years? Not six. More than 400 years. Generations enslaved. And what did slavery look like in Egypt? Well, it wasn't something you valued. It wasn't something you looked forward to. It wasn't something that was mediated in any kind of kind and loving way. Just the opposite. And God set them free from that. God liberated the entire nation from slavery. He did not want them to be perpetually known as slave masters, holding their own people in slavery. Even if there was a time when someone had need and they enslaved themselves to another, you were limited in how you could apply that. And in the seventh year, you let them go. And, by the way, when you let them go in the seventh year, there's no payment made by the previous provider. They were then on their own. This was how you would love your neighbor with God in mind. To liberate in the seventh year, you had to actually think about God and slavery. Now look at verse 3. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he's the husband of a wife, when he becomes a slave, then his wife shall go out with him. What's the point of that statement? Well, you notice the focus is on the slave's release. Release from slavery is the subject. If he came in single, he leaves single. If married, he leaves married. The Lord is not going to overturn or break up the family in this case. This is care for the family of the slave. And it's just for all the parties. Verse 4 is where we get into trouble, isn't it? You say, well, I was waiting for you to get there, and you've just been belaboring it for the last number of minutes. All right, well, look at it. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him, talking about the slave, the master gives the slave a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. It's still talking about the seventh year and the release of the slavery, right? You say, well, that sounds completely unfair. Where's love there? That sounds so unjust. Well, I think it expresses extraordinary care. Extraordinary care. If a man entered slavery, it was likely because his economic and social situation was one of extreme need that could not be solved by himself, to the point that he gives himself over to another person to provide complete care in return for the work. What then would the slave possess upon his release after 6 years? What do you think he owns? Nothing. He has nothing. It's not like he opened a savings account while he was working. He was setting money aside so that in that seventh year he would have enough he could live on. It's not like he had another gig lined up when this one ended. No, the slave had nothing at all. And in the seventh year, no payment is made to him, so he has no income whatsoever. No home, no job, no ability to provide for himself, and he would need to establish himself. And a male slave could do that. They at least had the opportunity, they could go out once they were released and try to make a living for himself. Well, what if he was given a wife and had children? Well, this, I think, is a statement of care, and it's required of a master for those that he gives to the slave. The picture is a hardship for the slave and his family might actually be created by the seventh year liberation. The slave has the opportunity to establish an income over time, but his wife and children would not. They would have nothing to maintain care for the most vulnerable in this situation created by the seventh year liberation. The master is obligated to care for the wife and children of the released slave. That's why you see a quick pivot in verse 5. But if the slave plainly says, "I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man," then his master shall bring him to God, then he shall bring him to the door of the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he'll serve him permanently. So in verse 4, you see the master has to provide care for those who cannot provide for themselves. A wife and children that the master provided. And perhaps it is that when this slave goes out and he finds an income and he's able to establish himself, the family can be reunited. But it's very likely that that man says, "No, I don't want to leave my family or the care of my master." And he actually says here that there's a relationship constructed on love. Did you notice that in verse 5? If the slave plainly says, "I love my master," which gives you some kind of indication of what was going on in the care of a master for those who worked for him. Complete care. "I love my master. I love my wife and my children. I'm not going out as a free man on my own to try to figure this out on my own when I have nothing. I'll stay under him. This is a good situation. This is a good employer, as it were. He cares for us. He provides for us. This is good work." And he stays with him. Then he has to go before God. This could be to the tabernacle. This could be just a statement. Perhaps a priest was involved, and it could have been in relationship to the master's home where his ear was placed on the doorpost of the home to indicate that he now belongs to this home. And a permanent mark is made for him to say he is permanently connected to this family, which means that the master would have to provide complete care for this man and his family for the rest of their lives, so that people in Israel were caring for one another and their needs. This is provision for the needy. This is love from the provider. This is care for those who are the most vulnerable to be taken advantage of, the least influential in the culture, who can't do anything for themselves. Verse 7, this one probably troubles us a little bit. Well, if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, and you stop right there and you say, what is he thinking? He sells his daughter as a female slave, and well, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. Well, that, you just read that verse in America, and you're likely to be arrested. So she's not as valuable as the man? Well, consider the situation again. The man selling his daughter is in such a financial position, he cannot provide for her. He cannot provide for his family. And he sells his daughter in order that she would be provided for. She's brought under the care of another because he cannot provide for his family. She gains security and safety. So what happens in the seventh year, in the year of liberation? Is she set free? Is she going to go out and be able to get a job? Not likely. It's not how it worked in the ancient world. Would she be able to go and establish herself in her own career? Absolutely not. What would she have, and what means of support would she gain? Nothing. Nothing. So, you don't let her go out on her own. You keep providing for her. She's one of the most vulnerable and the most needy in the culture. And if you love God, you show it in loving people by showing the most needy in your society the greatest care. What about the difficult to stomach situation in verse 8 and 9? It just gets worse, doesn't it? If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, let's just stop right there for a moment. What does that mean? Well, she was sold under a master, and perhaps the master then says he's bringing her as his wife. Or, as was frequent in the ancient world, men had multiple wives. It's not God's design. It's not God's original design, but it was permitted in the ancient world without the extreme judgment of God. We see it in the lives of Abraham and others. So if that's the case, that she's brought under this man's house, he brings her in as his wife, and somehow then she becomes displeasing in the eyes of her master, does he have the right to do whatever he wants with her? If one day he just wakes up and says, I don't like her anymore, can he just throw her away and do whatever he wants with this woman who is now completely vulnerable? No. He shall let her be redeemed. She'll be able to be bought and provided for and redeemed by another. He does not have the right to simply jettison her without care. In fact, notice how it's phrased in verse 8. He does not have authority. This is a limitation, not a right. It's a limitation. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. The whole idea here is if this is what this man does to this woman, this is unfair, it is unjust, it's not right, and he must care for her. He can't just throw her away. Now, you know what happened in the other nations? In regard to a situation like that, there were no laws like this. There was no such care. There was no such limitation of a master. He would do whatever he wanted. Not so in Israel. Not so. He doesn't have the authority. You can't send her to another nation who would treat her far worse, because there's no reverence for God in the nation, the other nations, so there's no way that you could sell her to another nation that has no regard for God and his ways. Verse 9, if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of what? Daughters. Oh, if you bring this woman into your home to provide and then you give her in marriage to your son, what does she become to you? A daughter. What is that saying? God is saying, this is what I want. You care for her like now she's one of yours. She's your daughter. This is God caring for the most vulnerable, the least influential in society. It's first, right out of the gate. You won't take advantage of anybody. Again, consider the limitations put on a master who might be tempted to unjustly treat a female slave that he had married. Verse 10, if he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her, that is the previous woman bought into slavery. He may not reduce her food or clothing or her conjugal rights. So if you're going to go and marry others, you can't disregard the necessary care and provision for the previous. And, verse 11, if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. The man gets nothing. She can go out. Again, what's happening in this entire section? Slavery in Israel among Israelites was a way to provide for those who had extreme need. Slavery could never become a situation where the one with the upper hand could take advantage of those most vulnerable, most needy, and absolutely uninfluential in society. To show the love of God, you showed love first to those most needy among you. It's echoed in Leviticus 25:43. You shall not rule over him, a slave, with severity. You are to revere your God. Think about that. You have no right to treat even a slave in a severe way because you revere God. God drives the ethic. Your view of God drives your compassion, your obligation to provide. It's very similar to what we see in the New Testament. Paul instructing slaves who are Christians and masters who are Christians. Yes, if you have the opportunity to gain your freedom, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 says you could pursue your freedom. Pursue that. That's good. That's best. In fact, that's what it's going to be in the new world. There is no slavery. Because there is no need. But in the world where you find that, have you noticed that the New Testament addresses those who are masters of slaves? Ephesians chapter 6, verse 7. With good will, render service as to the Lord, not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. Verse 9, and masters, do the same thing. Do the same thing and give up threatening, knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. What? If you're a master and you're a Christian and you have slaves in that ancient world context, you have no right to threaten or to treat in a severe way, but with kindness and constant provision for them, because their master is not you. Your master is not you. You have a master in heaven, and you are obligated to him. In other words, you have to think about God in regard to your ethics. Every law had its connection to God, and what you did with others reflected on God. I'm telling you, this ethic regarding slavery was completely contrary to how the ancient world viewed it. Right out of the gate, the most needy, God says you will treat in the most honoring way and meet every need and provision. Colossians 4:1, masters, grant to your slaves justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master in heaven. Again, you act in a just way because you are under God. You reflect him. God's laws called God's people to give careful, intentional consideration to how they viewed the least powerful, least influential, most vulnerable in society. Every Israelite was to represent God to the nations. As a nation, they showed the world, we're different. God rules us. That's the mind of God. You care for the most vulnerable. That's how you love your neighbor. Those are the laws that love the most vulnerable, the least influential. Let's look at another emphasis in Israel's laws that governed how they showed love for others. Second part of this is from verse 12 to verse 36. These are laws that value every life. So you're going to protect the least influential, and you're going to value every human life. You're going to value all life. That has to define you. You love those and you provide for those who can't provide for themselves, and you value life. That's what we find in verses 12 through 36. These are laws regarding personal injury, laws that love and value human life. I know that they appear to be very detailed, they're specific, they're sometimes very difficult to relate to the way that we see life today, but these laws were so significant for an ancient people, especially significant in light of the surrounding nations who did not value life to this degree. Life was not valued at all. It could be thrown away because they didn't see themselves, other nations, in relationship to the Creator. And certainly they didn't see themselves in relationship to Yahweh, the God of the Bible. So here's how Israel was to display the priority of Yahweh and value people created in His image. Fundamentally, humans should preserve life by protecting life from the kind of personal injury that puts life at risk. There's all kinds of laws here. First, he starts with laws regarding injuring any kind of person, any person. Verse 12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. That's pretty plain, isn't it? It's fundamental, goes back to the sixth commandment. If you murder, you receive the death penalty. Why? Because you don't value life. If you show that you have no value for human life, you're a threat to the rest of the community. You don't represent God. You're contrary to God's ways. He who strikes a man so that he dies is acting out of an unholy anger that is spilled over to strike another person so that his life is ended. I mean, we saw two very significant examples of that this week, did we not? Where raw anger with no connection to a value of God spilled over into an intentional taking of human life. One on a subway, caught on video. It's horrifying. Another on a college campus, where two people who do not value life thought they had the right just to take life. Again, in ancient Israel, and according to God, even before Israel's laws, you can see it in just the new world that was created after the flood in Genesis chapter 9. If you take life, your life will be taken because you show no value for life. You show no value for God because you don't view people as created in God's image. You don't look at them and say, they're bearing the very image of God. I can't touch or harm them in a way that has no concern for life. That devalues God. This was absent from the mind of those two individuals this week, and countless others where murders have been committed in our country and around the world. There are other provisions, especially if it's accidental. Look at verse 13. But if you did not lie in wait for him, meaning this wasn't planned, it's an altercation between two people angry with one another. Tempers flare. And it says, God let him fall into his hand. This is fascinating. It's as if to say, there's an altercation that takes place. It wasn't planned. It flares up. And by the providence of God, one man loses his life because of the altercation. It wasn't premeditated. It wasn't right. Because now God says, If by my providence I allow this to happen, then I will also provide a place of mercy where the murderer can go. He can flee. And that's the way he would preserve his life, because he didn't do this intentionally. It wasn't out of just raw devaluing life or God. It was accidental. So I'll appoint a place. You can read about them in Numbers chapter 35. He has to run to that place because you took a human life. Even if accidental, you have to value life. And so you have to go and spend the rest of your life in one of these cities of refuge. And if you ever walk out of that, then the murderers, the one murdered, the family members of them, can take your life legitimately because God values life. If, however, verse 14, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily. What does that mean? He planned this. He secretly planned it. laid it all out. Here's how I'm going to take it. Here's how I'm going to do it. Then you are to take him from, even from my altar. You say, what? What if this guy planned this out, but he runs to the tabernacle, grabs hold of the altar and says, but I've sinned. I'm appealing to God for justice and mercy. Peel him off of the altar and take his life. That's what it says. He doesn't represent me. He planned this. He intended this. He carried it out craftedly in secret and took this person's life. That shows no value of human life. It shows no value of God himself. Go take him from the altar. He's not connected to God. It's justice. It's justice. Verse 15 turns to injuring parents. Verse 15, he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. It combines the fifth and the sixth commandments. If you have such dishonor for the very people God used to give you life, and you strike them in anger and hatred, you hate life. Our culture was just looking at this one again, staring it in the face in the last few weeks. Did you hear about the Menendez brothers from the early 90s? I mean, some of you, I'm looking around the room, you have no idea who they are. It was such a long time, it was over 30 years ago. I remember it well. I actually pastored a church where one of the jurors was one of the deacons of our church. Some fascinating conversations we had about that. But they came up for parole, which I thought was interesting because they were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole because of the brutality of the murders. They went in and unloaded shotguns on their parents. And because mom still seemed to be breathing, one went back out to the car, reloaded the gun, came back in and shot her until he couldn't hear her breathing anymore. Absolutely brutal, unparalleled kind of violence. Even California said, you can't get out of jail until they changed the law. And said, well, maybe we should give them another chance. And you're like, that's California. Well, think about this. Even there, in that system, when the current system was looking at the case again and the behavior of the perpetrators and the brutality of the crime, even in California, under new laws, they couldn't let these guys out. There was at least still a vestige of conscience. Because what you've done to parents is so heinous. Well, if you can't value those who gave you life, you don't value life. Verse 16, we've talked about already, this is stealing people. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he's found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. You can't steal a person and possess them by stealing them. You don't value life. The death penalty was applied for that. Because you don't regard the image of God. That's what you're saying if you do that. You have no regard for the image of God. And that's exactly how slavery was in our country. People were viewed as if they weren't people. That they weren't human beings who carried the image of God completely and fully. In Israel, that would have brought the death penalty. What about verse 17? This seems to be similar, different, and in our minds, maybe lesser than what we see in verse 15 about parents. It's cursing parents. Verse 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. You say, well, really, the death penalty for saying a derogatory word? Well, that's not what a curse is. A curse is calling for God to kill someone, calling for God to bring judgment down on someone. It means you don't want your parents to live. You're calling down God's judgment on them. It means you really have no regard for their life. You lose your life because you say, I don't value life. Verses 18 and 19 are quarreling injuries. What about anger towards someone that results in violence but not death? Well, that's not a love of life. The loveless actions of violence that don't result in death still must receive justice. Look at verse 18. If men have a quarrel, it means there's anger. There's hatred in their heart toward one another, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed. If he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished, meaning he won't die because life still exists. He didn't take life, but he shall pay for his loss of time. You'll make sure that he is not out anything that he could have worked for and made provision for himself. And he shall take care of him until he's completely healed. What do you think that would look like in our world? You get in a fight with someone because you hate them and you picked up a stone, which means you're pretty mad, and you hit them to such a degree it brings them down and they're out of work for a while. Not only are you going to pay for his loss of time where he's not able to work, but you're going to care for him until you've brought healing to him. Something will have to have changed in your heart, in how you view them and how you view life. This is God saying, you don't treat people with disregard. You treat them with care, kindness, provision. What about injuring a slave? Verse 20, if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he, and I think you can read there, or she, survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Meaning, essentially, he belongs to that person's care. Well, what is the punishment if the slave dies? Literally, the text says, he shall suffer violence. Suffer violence. What does that mean? You lose your life. If you have no regard for the life of even a slave, and you strike them to the point where they die, you suffer violence. It's a life-for-life injury. I know that phrase, for he is his property, is troubling, but it's another way to say you are still responsible to provide care. You have an obligation. You can't miss the obligation. Friends, that would have been such a radical departure from the way slaves were treated in the secular or pagan culture, where slaves could be treated with malicious intent or even killed because their life was not valued at all. I mean, you see that. You remember how Pharaoh treated the Israelite slaves with no regard for their well-being, beat them severely, increased their workload, and did not give them what they needed to do the work. And people died at his hands, and there was no consideration. Israel could not live that way because they represented God. Verses 22 to 25 are fascinating. It's the injuring of pregnant and the preborn. Verse 22, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand. And he shall pay as the judges decide. So you're going to be responsible to the husband and the courts. If two men are struggling and they strike a woman with child, and you say, why is this the scenario? If you are in an angry dispute with someone and your anger strikes out and affects the life of another, do you value their life? This should make you think before you get into that quarrel. But notice verse 23, if there's any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life. Is that an injury to the woman or an injury to the preborn baby? We're not told, which I think is purposeful by God to say either. Think about that. How much does God value a preborn life? If you engage in a conflict, if you engage in something that takes the life of an unborn human being, you could lose your life for that because you show you have no value for life. You harm a mother and she dies, and likely then the baby dies also. You show you have no regard for life, you have no regard for God, life for life. What if you harm a slave and simply You don't kill them, but you maim them. Verse 26, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave, either one, and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye, because you've now created a hardship where he's perhaps not able to work. You've not valued his life. Verse 27, if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. In other words, you don't have the right to treat them however you want. You have an obligation to treat them as if they bear the image of God. What about an animal? That's where they go next. Verse 28. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. I don't know what it's like to stone an ox. That's some pretty big stones. But the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. So if you have just an incident, the ox gores someone, the ox dies. If, however, verse 29, an ox was previously in the habit of goring and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall also be put to death. Why? Because the owner shows, I know that this animal is taking life and I have no regard for life. Life for life. The end of it. Verse 33. If a man opens a pit, digs a pit, and does not cover it over, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? You gain a dead animal. If you cause that animal to lose its life because of your actions. And if one man's ox hurts another's so it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide its price equally, and they'll also divide the dead ox. Or if it is known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall become his. Interestingly, the death penalty is not applied because animals aren't created in the image of God. You see the connection? You see, well, what's the point of all of this? Do you value life? And how's that work out in the details? Do you value life? There's all kinds of issues that go on day in, day out. You're going to get in a conflict with someone. Do you value life to such a degree you would control yourself because you believe you're accountable to God and you believe that they are created in the image of God, so you have to watch what you say? You have to watch how you act because you believe you're accountable to God? This is nothing short of the rule of God among his people so that the nations see the rule of God, the justice of God, the kindness of God, the provision of God has to be seen in how we love one another because that shows the world what we think of God. That was Israel's point. And by the way, it's ours. Now we can get into this great discussion on whether or not all of this means that America should have these laws. And that would be a far departure from what this text is saying. America is not Israel. It is not the chosen nation of God. However, let's think of it this way. What kind of ethics should rule us if Christ is ruling us as God's people? Probably an ethic that looks very similar to this. The purpose of the church is not to create laws in a culture according to the old covenant law. The purpose of the church is to evangelize people to make them disciples of Jesus. And when they become disciples of Jesus, they begin to influence the culture. And what will the culture then begin to look like? It's pretty simple. You can go create all the laws you want until you affect the heart. It's not going to really affect the society. I certainly want laws that reflect righteousness. That's how I vote when I go into the voting booth. I want to reflect what I think is a right, righteous way of living. But my primary focus as a congregation, as a church, as a Christian, is the evangelization of those who don't come under the rule of God. So we have to ask ourselves, what does the rule of Jesus look like among us? As we simply relate to one another, as we care for one another, as we provide for the most needy among us, do we look like we value people created in the image of God in the way we treat one another and interact with each other and handle our disputes among one another? Because the world is watching us too. The world is watching how we argue. The world is watching how we create disputes. And if the Lord Jesus Christ, who perfectly obeyed the Father and gave us the power to be able to live out a righteousness that reflects him, and he rules us, the world should see the character of God in us. We should bear his image as the body of Christ. No, we're not Israel. We're the church. We're not a nation in the sense that we're a political entity, not in the sense that America is. But we are a people, and we are called to govern ourselves under the rule of Christ. And that ethic should reflect that we see ourselves accountable to God in the way we treat people, particularly the most vulnerable, the least influential in society among us. How do we think about them, care for them, and love them? And when we think about how we interact with one another, do we actually display that we value life because God created life and it's created in his image? That shows the rule of Christ among us. Let's pray together. Father, we pray that you would now begin to expose in us where our hearts are, in how we value others in reflection of whether we value you. You are the fundamental rule of life. You're the one in whom we should see all of life related. Laws should protect what you have created because of who you are. Lord, we know we live in a land, in a place, in a time where the devaluing of life seems to be on the rise. We pray that that would not be because the church is filled with angry people. Let us be a people, Lord, who are known for our forgiveness, known for the purity of relationships that we have among us, known as a kind and providing people for the most vulnerable and the least influential. Help us to be a people who don't just fight for life, but we preserve, we provide for those who have great need because we value life, all life. Grant us your grace, Lord, as we seek ways in which we would display the image of God under the rule of Christ for your glory. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's stand together.